Up next on Stack Overflow, Joel and Jeff discuss the mythical man-month problem, keeping communication in check, Windows 7, and web scaling. From IT Conversations on the Conversations Network.
This is Jeff.
Well, who else would it be? I called Jeff.
Why are you eating lunch? It's like 4 p.m. there.
I'm sorry. I noticed that in the little chat window in Skype, they have it throwing up. I'll send you that.
Yeah.
But they don't have eating.
You'd wonder if eventually there'd be some standardization on emoticons, right? Like every device would have a standard set of these things.
It's probably an IEEE standard.
Yeah. It's certainly a candidate for it anyway.
Well, this is podcast 63063.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get the problem where you plug in your iPhone and it says the iPhone
what,
that you plugged in?
What is
in
going on over there?
Could not be recognized. Please
unplug. Is there like a car full of clowns going in circles over there?
Plug it
in
again.
I mean, what is going on?
This is going to be a great podcast.
You have not been the same since Fogbug 7 was released. There was something in that product that is not right.
Well, Fogbug 7 is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
There's another product here that the interns have been building along with three experienced software developers from the Fog Creek team as their mentors, and also co-programmers, basically. So it's like a programming team of nine.
Wow, that's a big team.
Plus two testers and two program managers. So it's really more like 13 people on that team, yeah, which is the largest team we have ever fielded. And you know how they always say, like, you can't schedule software. If you try to just double the number of people and have the amount of time that you spend doing things, it's like trying to get nine pregnant women to make one baby in 1 month.
Yes.
You know, that funny little expression.
Absolutely.
Well, turns out that with software, that's not completely true.
Are you debunking another important myth on our podcast? Is that what you're doing, Joel?
I might just have to because, you know, the limitation that we face with summer interns is they only got 10 weeks.
Yeah.
And even that is kind of a stretch because there's a couple of stupid colleges that give people their vacation later than everybody else. And some not so stupid colleges. So actually, in our case, it's University of Chicago and Stanford, both let people out really late. And meanwhile, the other people have to go back to school kind of early. And so you only wind up with 10 usable weeks during the summer to build a product if you're going to try to build it with interns.
Right.
So we just we split up the work and we had very very detailed specs and we figured out what everybody's going to do in advance. And we're not going to really finish it this summer, but we will have a feature complete beta by the end of the summer.
Cool. So throwing a bunch of people. So there's my challenge. Well, okay. I'm probably shouldn't be speaking about having large teams because my whole philosophy is predicated on having really small teams as I can possibly get away with.
Yeah.
And keeping them small. But I guess as long as you have, you know, work for everybody to do and they're not stepping on each other. I mean, that was always the big problem, you know, the mythical man month problem was that people just start to interfere with each other. They're blocking each other. There are communication breakdowns. There's all these reasons that stuff doesn't scale. So I guess if you have some kind of parallelizable workflow where people aren't stepping on each other and they all have stuff to do and they can just work somewhat independently, I guess you're right. That could work.
Well, the real argument that Mythical Man Month makes is actually a little bit weaker than the argument that everybody remembers. Everybody remembers, oh, you can't just put a lot of people on a team. But what the Mythical Man Month actually says is a slightly narrower claim. It says if a project is late, adding more people makes it later.
I see.
So it's really saying something about like people coming up to speed and all the communication it takes to get everybody onto the same page and all that kind of stuff. There are ways of addressing the problem of making a large team more effective than a small team. But sometimes you just have so much work to do that there's just no way that you can ever get it done with a small team and you really have no choice. And so at that point, your goal becomes mitigating the large number of communication paths you've created. So the mythical man month problem allegedly comes from the fact that if you have n people on the team, then you have, you know, an order of n squared, so n squared over 2 minus 1 communications paths if everybody's going to communicate with everybody. And so that goes up as a function of n squared, it's order of n squared. And so if you have a team with 10 people, there are, you know, around, what, 50 communications paths? Mm-hmm. And if you have a team of half that many people, 5 people, there are only, you know, 12 communication paths. Getting that wrong, it's 10, right?
I thought you were supposed to square it.
Somebody
check my
math.
You're squaring it, dividing it in half. I don't know what's going on over there.
Well, because if you and I have to communicate, if you actually make a square, you and I don't actually have to communicate. That's only one communication path.
Let me put this in terms that our audience can understand. This show that was on for a long, long time called Love Lines, which is kind of one of those weirder radio shows, and it had Adam Carolla for a long time.
He's got a great podcast now.
Yes, he does. It's very, very good. And Dr. Drew Pinsky. Mm-hmm. And one of the recurring themes, there are a lot of recurring themes, being a call-in show about sex and love, there are a lot of crazy, wacky things that happened on it. And I went through a period when I was up late, and I'm always up late, and I would listen to this show, and I listened to it for a period of weeks. And there was a theme, which was that anytime someone would call in and say, "We're considering having a three-way relationship," there was always a theme of like, you could almost hear the groaning in the background from Dr. Drew Pinsky. And this is a guy who's, you know, he's kind of a medical professional, and he's just seen this pattern over and over that once you add a third person to a romantic relationship, the odds of it breaking apart are like very, very high.
Well, because you now have three relationships to maintain instead of one.
And that's just adding one person.
Right.
That's the whole communication thing. Yep. Now, granted, it's a romantic relationship, so these are harder to maintain than, say, a work relationship. But I think the principle still applies. It's just stark how, you know, deeply adding just that one additional link to a romantic relationship destabilizes it radically.
Yeah, and you and your wife just had a baby recently, so you probably experienced that firsthand.
Yes. Well, the baby's not a romantic relationship.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. I missed that.
That of that kind. But, certainly the principle is there.
Right. So that's the Mythical Man Month theory. And then the way that we address this on software teams, there's really sort of two approaches to addressing this. Number one is through the use of a person whose title is program manager, who sees their job as communicating with everybody. And so you try to go for more of a star communication topology than an everybody talks to everybody communication topology.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a certain amount of broadcast messages that everybody subscribes to. We do that through check-in. So anytime somebody commits code into the version control system, everybody reads the commit, or they read the comment at least, and then they read the code if they care. And it's just sort of a way of everybody announcing what they're working on without all having to talk to one another. That helps a lot. But the other thing that I think is actually kind of interesting is that whereas the architects, and by architect I mean people who design office space, tend to believe that open space fosters open communication, and open communication is very important, and modern high-tech companies like software companies should be all about massive amounts of communication between everybody and as much communication as possible, and communication is awesome. When you actually get out into the field of building very complex things with a very large team of people working on very detailed stuff, you discover that what you really want to do is minimize communication. It's like you're always looking for ways that if somebody doesn't need to know something, they don't find out, because all that is noise to that person. And so you're constantly looking for ways of reducing the number of people that are involved in things. So for example, every time you have a meeting with 10 people, well, that's 10 people that all got to sit around and waste time hearing about things that they may or may not care about. And if you can reduce that, instead of being a meeting of all 10 people, just make it, you know, maybe the program manager goes to 3 people and talks to them individually, then you've wasted dramatically less time. Or, for example, the difference between the general approach of Basecamp. In Basecamp, people are just constantly getting notified of everything. And that's sort of the default behavior, is to tell everybody on that other team something, or tell everybody on the team something. And the default behavior of Fogbugs is that it's extremely difficult to do anything other than assign something to one person at a time. So, my philosophy of software teams is like everybody finding out about everything is politically very astute and makes people feel very happy and gets everybody involved, but they don't need to be involved. And your whole goal is to try to trim down the amount of involvement that everybody has to just the areas where they need to be involved, so that you have any kind of hope of moving forward on a large team with a lot of people.
Wasn't that analogous to the push communication versus the pull communication? In other words, need to know implies that, you know, rather than sending an email and interrupt, essentially a broadcast interrupt out to people, let the people find the information that they need. So really then, I guess what you're struggling with is making sure that everybody who needs to know something has a way of finding it that doesn't involve interrupt-based communication.
Sure.
So if you're not sending out all these emails about what's going on, there's like some central website or something where they can go, hey, I'm working on X, now I need to know Y.
Right.
So I'm going to go to our website Z and click on it, and oh, now I have the information I need, and I'm unblocked.
Yep.
So there's not all this interrupt-driven communication going on. And certainly email, I think, is a great example of that. And I think a lot of people who have a public internet persona eventually kind of give up on email.
Exactly.
It's really challenging.
I think everybody's getting ready to give up on email. It's not just the people with the public internet persona.
Yeah, yeah.
I already have all my public internet persona email going to a separate folder, which I can only really, you know, I can read, but that's about it.
But you said you reply to all. You guys should all email Joel, because he said he replies to every real human being email that he gets. Which I do not make that promise.
I do not. I absolutely do not reply to anybody who emails me through my website. What I do is I reply to people that send an email to my work address, and 9 out of 10 times, it's just a customer with a customer type question, and there are people that get paid here to reply and say, Joel asked me to get back to you on such and such a matter.
I see.
Usually because if somebody's emailing me and they're asking about when their Frogwigs license expires and how much it would cost to renew it.
Well, those are paying customers, so that's a different thing.
Yeah, they all get quick replies. But yeah, people that just email my address on the website, I do actually read it all. And I reply to some of it. Every once in a while I'll go in there, especially if I have a long flight, I'll go in there and I'll answer 100 emails or something. Mm-hmm. It also sort of depends. People aren't so good at sending email that can be replied to.
Oh, God, don't even get me started.
Like, here, this will be fun. Here's some classes of email that I can't respond to whatsoever. The first is an extremely lengthy story that should have been a blog post about some experience that you had in the software development field.
The wall of text.
That was amusing. Yeah.
The wall of text. That's my favorite. It's like you should open it and you're just like, I regret even clicking on this thing.
Well, no, sometimes the story is great and it's funny and I read it and I'm like, hey, great story. Okay, bye. It's sort of disproportional. The guy spent an hour composing what should have been, you know, a short story or something. So I can't do anything about that. Number two, when somebody says, hey, I'm just writing to ask you, if I asked you a question, would you be able to answer it? They're asking if they can ask you a question, or asking if they can ask you a favor, or asking if they can. And then you don't want to say yes, because they're going to ask you.
Then you're
going to
get another email. Saying, yes, please send me more email.
Sure, go ahead. Send me your question. And then they send you a question, and it's like, you know, would you
wall
fund my startup, or should I divorce my wife? It's something you can't answer. There's just no hope, right? So that's the second category. The third category is the one where you spend a lot of time trying to decipher what the hell they're even talking about, because they're sort of not very good communicators, not very good writers, and there's this wink-wink. They're like, you know, the problem with a yeah, haha, you know what I mean, and they're referring to some article that maybe you wrote, or maybe it was just one of the commenters. They didn't understand that it was a commenter on your blog. It was not actually you writing that thing, and it was like 4 years ago, and they just found it, and they assume that it's in the top of your head that you just wrote it, you know, yesterday, and this is all you're thinking about. So you can't even decipher their email. Then there's a whole category of, hey, you got to check out my product, of people that are just like,
check out my thing.
If Joel wrote about our product, everybody would buy it and all our problems would be solved. And since I don't really write about products that much, and certainly not products that somebody wants me to write about, I guess I could. I could turn into a software review website where just people submit me the thing that they're working on, and I could write about it and say, no chance, never going to work.
Yeah, this talk of email is just depressing me. Because, I mean, you don't really want to step on communication. It feels wrong to come out against communication.
Right.
Because communication is also the source of so many solutions to problems, right? I mean, in relationships and work.
Yeah.
So to come out and say, you know what, there's too much communication, we've got to stamp out all this communication, sort of goes against the grain. I think it's hard for people to
reconcile. I'm willing to come out against it. And I especially want to come out against the communication that is just friggin' noise. It's even more Like, I really feel like that's what Twitter is. It's just like more communication that's unlikely to ever.
Well, let me give you an example. Okay, so Twitter works in unexpected ways. I can't fully explain why I like Twitter so much. I'll just get that out there. But let me give you a concrete example. This weekend we watched the documentary Tilt, The Battle to Save Pinball, which is a great, great documentary about this. There's almost nobody making pinball anymore in the U.S. And there's a little documentary about they had this last-ditch engineering effort to sort of come up with a next-generation pinball machine.
Right.
And they essentially succeeded at what they were – this very, very ambitious goal that they thought was impossible. But and not to spoil the movie, it's kind of a foreground conclusion. They were canceled anyway. So, but anyway, it's a great story. It's a super neat engineering project, wonderful movie. It's called Tilt, the Battle to Save Pinball. So I put in a Twitter message about, oh, I finally watched Tilt, and it was really, really good. And then the guy who wrote Tilt, the guy who made Tilt, replied to me. He said, at Coding Horror, hey, thanks for the nice words regarding Tilt. I mean, that's awesome, right? I mean, that's fantastic. So
it is?
Me broadcasting, I think so. I mean, I just had a
waste of time.
Why is that a waste of time? It's a momentary connection between me and this guy who made this incredible thing that I really, really enjoyed. Why is that bad? How is that not a
It's not bad. It just doesn't get what do you gain from that? Not a
well, now I have a connection with this guy. I mean, he responded to me, so.
But you have the most fleeting. You already had a connection with him. He made a movie and you watched it. And that's so much more substantial than now, like he's auto-replied to your tweet. It's not like you can go over to his house and hang out with him.
This was a handwritten Twitter response.
You may not even want to go out to his house and hang out with him.
Well, like I said, I can't fully quantify it. I've also gotten answers to my problems. I mean,
yeah, we get answers to our problems because we have so many followers. And that's
cool. We cheat. Yeah, it's cheating. I know, we're cheating.
Maybe that's what it is. This is just going to be a way for celebrities to get answers from there.
Well, I would much rather have, let me put it this way. I would much rather have somebody contact me on Twitter than email, without a doubt.
Yeah, because you can ignore them. Or no, you can reply in 140 characters.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You no longer have the wall of text. At the very least, A, it's public, which is nice, so it's searchable, at least in theory, although Twitter search is kind of really insane. And it's a limited 140 characters, so you can only ask very focused questions. So already we're winning, right? I mean, if all my email went to Twitter, I would be so much happier.
But so, if I send you a Twitter, it doesn't get in your inbox where you have to reply to it or delete it or something.
I don't have to reply to my email either.
But you would conscientiously. You still have to make a decision about it. I force you to make a decision about everything that I email you. With Twitter,
well,
the default
I'm forced
to
make a decision about stuff you send me because we're business partners.
That's
right?
True.
Because if I don't respond to you, eventually you get pissed off, understandably so, which actually has happened for the record. And then you start, you know, calling my house. So, yeah. I think there's different reasons. But I think the most important thing to take away from this is I really believe if 90% of the email I got became Twitter messages, I would be. People would get better responses if they got responses at all.
Yeah.
And my mental load would be reduced. So already that's a case for email as sort of a failed paradigm.
I sort of feel like communication is the real failed paradigm, that you need more communication of higher quality with a smaller number of people. So there isn't a whole lot of like having lengthy conversations with people just to shoot the breeze anymore. We've kind of given up on that. And instead of that, or instead of, you know, hanging out at the pub and just sort of socializing with a limited number of people, we now have these superficial relationships with zillions of people all over the internet.
I don't know how to parse that.
I don't either.
That's a very dramatic, broad statement that I can't reconcile. I feel like I have a much richer... I think you just got to change the medium. I think the Twitter to email comparison to me is the most salient point here. That you're trying to force communication into something that really scales. Email doesn't scale at all. Like, not even a little.
Right. But how does
and Twitter seems to scale so much better.
I mean, blogging sort of scales because many people can read something that you write.
It's just public. That's right. It's like public email, sure.
The trouble with Twitter, though, is that you get, as soon as a conversation threatens to become actually real, the 140K limit and the fact that you don't want to just sit there and tweet
all day
long.
But that's good. That's
actually
good, right?
forces you to stop. No, but then you're not having any kind of real conversation. So, for example, the only thing you'll ever find out about you can never find out in-depth information about a product on Twitter. You can just get people's opinions, like, I think it's great or I think it's awful.
Well, there's the whole – I actually blogged about this, but there's a theory of escalation. When you realize you've reached the limits of a particular sure. communication mechanism and yeah. you have to, like, escalate, you'd actually go to email. Like, I've had people – you know, have some Twitter conversations, and I say, well, let's just take this to email. And they write this long email, which is relevant to me because we were having a conversation, and I'm interested in the topic. It's not like the wall of text email. Mm-hmm, this is, you know,
right.
on topic.
Right.
So I think you have to know when you've reached the limits, and if you don't, then bad things happen. I mean, it's always possible to screw up. Just like it's possible to write Fortran in any language.
Yeah.
It's possible to abuse any communication mechanism, no matter how appropriate it may be.
I think, you know what I haven't seen a lot of is Twitter spam, but you're going to start seeing it.
I think there's been some. I think people are complaining about the spam followers, but right. I don't really follow. I mean,
well, people will write at Coding Horror, and then they'll send you a spam message.
Sometimes, but that's been pretty rare so far.
No, we're turning into This Week in Tech, just talking about Twitter all the time.
Sorry, I know.
Do you think?
But I have a different topic. Can I actually change topics?
Sure.
So on the last podcast, we talked about the Fogbug 7 API, and then we talked about plugin ecosystems.
Sure.
And one of the things I always struggle with plugin ecosystems is, you know, how do you balance plugins with development of the core product? And Richard Gadsden had a really nice response on the blog comments to this, and he had four classes of plugins that won't get steamrollered, you know, where you're snatching nickels, as you say, from the path of the oncoming steamroller. And I thought these were really good examples.
Okay.
So on to enumerate them. One of the class of plugins that you could have that would actually be supportable is plugins that make the product UI very, very complex. And he has a good example here of like NoScript, which is a plugin that sort of gives you browser safety at great cost, which is that JavaScript doesn't work anymore.
Right.
So for Firefox to include that as a default would be suicide, right? Oh, that whole JavaScript thing, we turn that off by default.
Yeah.
Right, that obviously doesn't scale. But for people that want that, they can run the NoScript plugin, and then that's a great example of a sort of a complex plugin that could potentially break a whole bunch of crap on the internet.
Right.
But some people want that. That's a great example.
Okay.
And then a plugin that intrinsically costs money, like some kind of subscription to, say, Major League Baseball or something.
Got it. So it's a plugin that actually it's delivered as a plugin, but there's actually some underlying thing that costs money. Like maybe it's an interface to some piece of hardware that you would need to buy.
Yeah, he gives an example of like a stock ticker or any sort of real high value
sure.
data stream that you wouldn't normally bundle with the product, right? Not everybody's into baseball,
right.
But there's all these sort of value add things you can buy on the baseball ecosystem if you're into that. But you wouldn't bundle that, obviously. You're going to say, hey, here's your product, and now you get to pay $10.
That makes sense. And actually, if you look on the App Store, a lot of the free apps that are really popular are exactly that. There's the Sonos free app for controlling your Sonos. There's the Amazon free app for buying things from Amazon. A lot of the apps that are actually free there are free because they assume that you're going to be purchasing something in some other forum. And so it's just a complimentary service.
Right. So any sort of plugin where you're building a conduit for money to go from place to place.
Mm-hmm.
Another example is plugins that break the business model of the core product. And the classic example of this is, of course, ad blocking. I mean, Firefox is not going to ship with ad blocking. Chrome is not going to ship with ad blocking. No browser is ever going to ship with ad blocking.
Yeah.
That wants to survive in the market. And again, a great example because the advertising, although I support tasteful advertising, and we try to do it tastefully on Stack Overflow, so many sites completely fail to do that. So, yeah. And then the final example is plugins that connect to a commercial product. An example actually using Fogbugs is the Balsamic plugin.
Right. So you have to buy that anyway.
Or
you're paying for that. Well, you're paying for that, actually. So.
Yeah, so Balsamic's business is selling Balsamic, not the plugin.
No, but we could make a balsamic-like product and just include it in Fogbugs. And the real reason we won't is because that's something only a small percent. That's the vertical case. We won't do that for vertical reasons. Like, it's too vertical for us. It's something that only a small percentage of Fogbugs users might use.
Right. So the only way, that's much too difficult of a large of a thing for you guys to consume.
Now,
those were great examples of plugins.
There's a fifth one, which is proprietary plugins that connect to some in-house thing that you just need to connect to. So somebody who's using Fogbugs that wants to integrate it with their internal knowledge base, or they want to integrate it with their internal build control system or something like that. They've got some kind of proprietary system that does builds all the time, and they want to make it, you know, report bugs in the build into fog bugs or something like that. So it could be a plugin that is so specific to one particular customer that they just need to build it for their own needs. Yeah. Sometimes when we hear about these, we discover things where something should have been built in, even though, like I'll give you one example. Let's say that you have a bug report, and you want to indicate what customer the bug report is for, and the customer has an ID number. So you turn on this custom field, customer, and you call it customer number, and you type in a number. And so now this appears in a custom field, but it's just a text field that just shows you the customer number. And what you really want is for that to be a hyperlink into your customer database. So when you click on that link, it takes you to the customer database, which may be some in-house product. So a lot of people are doing this in an ad hoc way. But if we made a plugin or a feature to FogBugs where you can make a custom field that we will display with any URL template around it, like we'll basically convert that number of the field into a hyperlink, and the hyperlink can be in any format you want, and we'll stick the number in wherever you have a placeholder for a percent S somewhere in there. Then in those cases, that's an example where like maybe there's a plugin that's perfect for you for your own internal use, but it suggests a feature in the product that would make that plugin obsolete.
Exactly.
Cool.
Yeah. So the plugin model, I think, obviously is a hugely important one. I mean, the products that have it tend to do so much better than the ones that don't. Certainly, a vibrant plugin ecosystem is a very strong sign of health for any project. I mean, and I know I keep talking about a Stack Overflow API. It's just we have so many other things in the queue ahead of that.
Sure.
But I realize that it's very strategic for us to have a fleshed out API, and it's something I absolutely want to get to.
Now, the other thing about an API or a plugin is it also creates a certain amount of lock-in, and this may be a good thing or a bad thing, depending on how you see it. But the lock-in that it creates is that once you've implemented some kind of a plugin API or something, what you've really done is you've exposed a lot of little function endpoints that have very, very specific behavior. And somebody else is going to write code that's going to call these function endpoints that use this specific behavior. And if for somebody to displace you, if people are relying on these plugins, they need to bring their plugins over. So for example, right now, almost everybody I know is not yet using Chrome because they're waiting for Adblock. Like they just need to be able to write a plugin for Chrome that can block ads. And as soon as that, and that's the most popular plugin, but there are a lot of other smaller plugins that people are relying on in Firefox, and they won't switch to Chrome or switch back to IE or certainly not Safari or Opera because those plugins aren't there on that other platform.
Oh, the lock-in, sure. That's a great example.
So the classic example I'll give was the first thing in my career was that Lotus 1-2-3 had Lotus macros. And Lotus macros, the way they worked is you went into a cell and you just entered a bunch of letters from your keyboard, you know, like slash C, M, or whatever. And then you could tell it to run that cell, and what it would do is actually generate those keystrokes that you had typed into that cell. You could thus automate Lotus 1-2-3 in certain rudimentary ways. And people started writing these, and they got very, very sophisticated, and they had these very, very complicated spreadsheets that had lots and lots of crap in the cells that was macros that they depended upon to run their business. And when they were trying to convert to Excel, you know, all the data in the spreadsheet opened fine, and the actual calculations were fine, but for the longest time, we couldn't run those macros. And so people would not convert from Lotus to Excel. And so what the Excel team eventually had to do was build a complete emulator of Lotus 1-2-3 that emulated the complete Lotus 1-2-3 user interface. So for a long time in Excel, it's not turned on now, but if you hit slash, a Lotus menu would pop up. It would have all the same things that Lotus 1-2-3 had in it. And that's still there behind the scenes. You just have to sort of enable it. And that took an enormous amount of work. So if you've got a product and you make a plugin API, or some kind of add-in API of some sort or macro language, the burden then, and you actually get people to depend on these plugins, then anybody that wants to come displace you is going to have to reproduce all the behavior of your API perfectly. which can be very, very, very hard. In the case of Excel, it's never been done, right? There's a huge surface area to that API.
Didn't Excel do that, what you're describing?
Well, we replaced the API of Lotus 1-2-3.
I see.
With a slash commands, and that was really, I mean, Lotus 1-2-3 was a DOS app that was about 100K, right? So it was a lot of work, but it wasn't that much. But in the case of Excel, we're talking about an object model with you know, 500 odd objects, and the documentation for that thing is probably 1,000 pages, and it's millions of little tiny functions that do tiny things in very, very specific ways. And you can try to emulate, you know, half that stuff or three quarters of that stuff, and you think, well, I'm emulating the most important functions. And then some guy runs his plugin, and it runs fine for about 0.00003 seconds, you know, and then it gets to mm-hmm. the one function that doesn't have a perfect emulation, or that doesn't exist, or that has a slightly different behavior, but just enough to make the plugin not work right.
Now, that's a great point, because that would be another thing that if people were trying to clone you, they would mm-hmm. have to clone that, mm-hmm. and they'd have to clone it perfectly, like you said, because there's... And probably the most compelling argument in favor of the whole API argument to me is that essentially you're outsourcing work. I mean, people are building things that make you look good
right.
with essentially no effort on your part.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
I mean, how can you really turn that down? That's such a great deal.
Right.
I mean,
that's
it's like, hey, I love your thing so much, I'm gonna build this thing that helps, that makes your thing look even better. You'd have to be an idiot on some level to turn that down. And I realize that, and I feel kind of, the more I talk about this, the more painful it gets, actually, because we just have other engineering stuff that's in the queue.
Well, these things are hard to do. I mean, they're really hard to do. The better part of 2 years for a couple of developers.
Yeah, but you have like a commercial product. I think for a site that's public on the internet, we can sort of dictate the terms. And I think our API can be kind of fluid, like for about 6 months. And people are more willing to put up with
fluidity.
I mean, it's not a commercial product. See, with Fogbooks, your people are paying for it. So if it changes every point release, they would be really pissed off.
Well, if you change yours every point release, then people that have developed plugins might break the plugin. And maybe they're not interested in fixing it this time. You still have some obligation to try to keep it as constant.
Not as much.
Well, let me ask you this, Jeff. What would you want plugins? What kind of plugins would you like to see for Stack Overflow? What kind of functionality would they have? What kind of things would they
I think probably the big one that people cite and the one I agree with is they just want an iPhone app, basically. They want a way to browse the site that's doesn't involve using, although Mobile Safari is fantastic and actually browses Stack Overflow brilliantly.
Yeah.
It's still pretty heavy because you're pulling down, you know, jQuery, you're pulling down just tons of things you don't really need on the iPhone to view a question, for example.
Right.
So I think that would be probably the number one goal, would be to whatever API it takes to support building a reasonable iPhone app, at least for browsing the site, if not actually asking questions.
One thing you might want to do is just at least make some of the most popular views have an XML mode. And that's really kind of it. Basically, you put an argument.
We don't really do XML. It's more JSON now.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah.
So you put an argument that says, and give me this in JSON instead of in HTML, and you just put that on certain URLs.
Oh, absolutely. And this is the whole model view controller. I mean, this is what it's all about. You have the database data, the fundamental unit of work, and you have different views that represent a question. And one of those views would be HTML. One would be JSON. Mm-hmm. So sure, I mean, this is what it's all about. I mean, this is the purest form of MVC as far as we're concerned.
Okay.
So something to get to.
So for however hard that may be, think about if somebody wanted then to, this is something we may have to do on Stack Exchange. Somebody wants to add some pretty deep new functionality to their Stack Exchange site.
Yeah.
To make it specific to their needs. I'll give you a great example on the airliners.net, where you talk about airplanes and airliners and mostly commercial aviation. If you ever type a two-letter airline code, it becomes a span with a title so that you can hover over it with a mouse that tells you the name of the airline. And similarly, if you type a three-letter airport code, you can hover over it with a mouse and see what the name of the airport is. So it's something that, like, you know, obviously no bulletin board system comes with, you know, out the door. And it's really only relevant to somebody that wants to make the airliner website. And so they're going to want some plug-in capability that allows them to at least rewrite some HTML in this way.
Sure. That's a good example.
So that would be a typical example of something that I can imagine somebody like right out the door wanting. There's the other example. There's something those guys that made that design site. Remember, they wanted the ability to push a blob of HTML through various browsers and get screenshots of what this HTML looks like in different browsers.
Right.
What am I talking about? What's that site called?
Doctype.
Oh, yeah. So this is they didn't really want to just do plain Stack Overflow because, you know, for web designers, they specifically wanted some features that allowed you to look at web design.
Exactly. No, totally makes sense. And since these are supposed to be verticals anyway, I mean, the whole concept of the stack is that you pick some topic that's fairly narrow, you know, reasonably narrow, that has some chance of succeeding. So you're already talking about stuff that's going to need tools for a certain audience. Like we've built in tools for programmers. That was one of our big hesitations with scaling the engine out, was that we had put in all this stuff to support our core audience. And as you move into, you know, people who are into airlines, people who are into, I don't know, horses, people who are into woodworking.
Woodworking? They're gonna have
I know. Crazy! Who would build a site for woodworking?
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So I have another topic for us. Actually, do you have any questions?
Know, we don't have any audio questions this week.
Really? Okay. Well, then I'll go off on my little topic then.
Do.
It's Windows 7. I installed Windows 7.
Wait, do you have the RTM version already?
I have the final.
How do you get the... Is that an MSDN thing? You
can magic.
Get
I just wave my hands and then just magically
okay,
appears.
I have a serious question for you, which I would have asked you, except that it was turning into a flame war on your discussion group there, on
what?
The comments in your blog. I have Windows 7 RC installed. Am I going to be able to upgrade it to Windows 7 RTM?
No, that's
why,
another reason.
Why?
I don't
why,
know.
Why,
I don't
why,
know.
Why?
See, that's why you should.
What the effing? What the hell is wrong with you, Microsoft? It's some DLLs. You just copy over them. You have been patching this operating system since Windows 1.0, and now the only time you can't do a simple patch is to get you from Windows 7 RC, the candidate that was almost good enough to release. It was a candidate. Could have been the final version.
Well,
and to
I believe
that to the
well now that you've
not possible?
Reacted so violently to that, let me add some caveats, which is I believe that to be true the last time I looked.
That is what they said, and I just don't get it. I don't get it. Why is it so friggin' hard? Because you know what this means is I have to reinstall everything. I have to start from a new computer and go find all my original CDs of everything and go find the stupid activation
See, this is
codes
why
for
I
all
waited
kinds
for
of random
RTM.
Products.
This is why. This is exactly why. Because I remember researching this and finding this out. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to mess with these betas and RCs if I can't just roll
Christ.
Over to
this
the final.
This is like the one thing about Windows 7. This is like snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, I swear to God, is that you can't upgrade to it.
Yeah, well, you're just bitter because you picked the wrong version. I have the RTM. I'm very happy.
Well, you still had to reinstall from scratch. You couldn't upgrade from Vista.
No, I upgraded from Vista, in fact.
Oh, wait, you're telling me you can upgrade from Vista but not from the RC?
Yes, I am telling you that.
So they're punishing all the people that were beta testing for them? Basically.
Apparently.
Oh, God, that makes me so mad.
It is unfortunate. It is
absurd. It's like, you know what? That's like the Android phone. It's an awesome phone. It has all the features you ever want. The battery only lasts half an hour. Well, gosh, I think that's a showstopper because sometimes I might need to make a phone call.
Yes.
That is ridiculous. Oh.
Yeah, it is unfortunate. Particularly, I agree with you completely as far as the RC because, I mean, I can see for the betas because the betas are wild and crazy.
Sure.
But once you get to the RC status, it's so close to
the
final.
Yeah, they gave it to millions and millions of people.
It does seem a little cruel.
And all they friggin' have to do is copy some friggin' DLLs that have changed into the new location and then reboot.
Yes. Yeah, so consider yourselves warned about that aspect. But
somebody's got to come up with like a hack that's just like, all right, here, install it in a fresh machine, copy these DLLs, put them in this place, set this registry setting, and reboot, and you'll be fine.
Yes. So if you remember in our first podcast, we talked about the whole Vista upgrade thing. And the point you made, which was, you know, totally valid, was that there wasn't enough there to really justify an upgrade from XP, which I do belatedly agree with. My issue with XP is just I hate running really old operating systems. It really bothers me at a fundamental level. So for me, Vista was good enough to move away from XP because it was modern. Mm-hmm. But they did get a lot of things, I don't want to say wrong, but there's a lot of really rough edges in Vista that sort of made you scratch your head. And
sure.
I think my first reaction to Windows 7 was that this is where all the polish went. You know, like when you install it, it has a nice install experience. The upgrade was very smooth for me from Vista. Basic fundamental things like using Windows Explorer is faster, it's cleaner.
Mm-hmm.
all those little details that they seem to just forgot about in Vista, they actually remembered in Windows 7. And I within 5 minutes of using it, I was just so much happier. I was like, wow, yeah, this is really pleasant to use in a way
Calc.
That Vista was not.
They fixed that bug in Calc, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, Calculator is like revamped. Paint is revamped. It's like they care now. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, Vista was like the operating system that just kind of got rushed out the door. And, you know, although the kernel had a lot of improvements, it had so many rough edges. And the example I like to use here is have you ever watched any of those shows on like home networks where they talk about selling your house?
All the time. Process? Designed to sell. It's HGTV, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And
Flip
they have
this house,
one show.
Designed to sell, Curb Appeal.
Yes. Yes, we used to watch those obsessively because we were actually looking at selling our townhome in North Carolina. And one of the things that we learned from these shows, there was one in particular that we really liked where they would have cameras that they would put in that mm-hmm. would actually watch the people as they went through the home.
Right.
Like, you know,
potential buyers.
Buyers,
yeah.
Potential buyers would come through and the cameras would record their reactions. And they would do it first initially just as is with uh-huh. the house exactly as the owners left it. And then they would spend like literally 1 or 2 days with a budget of $300
right.
and just like fix the house up so it was looked good to sell.
Yeah.
And then they would record the after, you know, people coming through the very same house, which has the same architecture, right? I mean, the house hasn't been rebuilt or anything. All they've basically done is rearrange all the crap in the house, get mm-hmm. rid of a lot of crap usually, slap some paint on the walls, buy like, you know, $50 worth of, you know, bonus items to put in the house to make it look good.
Right.
And it was always shocking to me how dramatic, like people could not see past, you know, this is an ugly couch.
Yep. Yep.
They would walk in a room and say, my God, that couch is hideous. You know, forget that this is the house that's like $50,000. Yep. That's an incredibly good deal. Has this, you know, beautiful
sure.
yard. It's like that couch is hideous. I can't
it's
take
maddening.
It.
And the reason they have such a low budget for fixing it up is because whatever stuff that they're spending on fixing it up is all going to get torn out by the new owners anyway. The first
yes.
thing they're going to do is they're going to come in and tear out all those new curtains and they're going to repaint the walls the color they like.
So Vista, to me, had that problem,
uh-huh.
which is architecturally it had some really nice improvements over XP, but for most people, and this is defensible, I'm not arguing that you shouldn't do this. I'm just trying to explain the human sort of
sure.
reaction to this, that Microsoft made a huge strategic error in not preparing their house to sell.
They also
shipping.
Didn't, yeah, they, and there's no granite countertop, so to speak, which is one of the things that the Apple does so well is that when a new version comes out, they give you built-in apps that just give you new functionality that can be demoed. Whereas
yes.
Vista versus XP was really just kind of a pushing things around and changing things and pestering you to type in your password more often. And there was no, like, well, you know, we made some core functionality here easier, or we've given you additional features that you can use.
Like, perfect example, somebody on Twitter replied, because I was talking about, oh, Windows 7, great experience, and he asked, can you actually rearrange the taskbar buttons now? You know, drag and drop them and slide them.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, you can. That's
yeah.
really cool, right? Like, well, I never need to do that because I don't care.
No, because
care about
these
that
are
stuff.
Also your not running programs. You pin them to the taskbar like on the Mac.
But you can rearrange
really
both running and not running.
Yeah.
You can rearrange everything.
But it's now that it's also you're not running, you kind of want to keep them in a reasonable order.
Yes.
This is how you
yes.
launch things.
It's just, it's very pleasant.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's really
every I just found a search thing the other day that's much improved. And I keep like turning little corners and finding little details that are just nicely implemented
mm-hmm.
In a way that on Vista it was like you would just.
One thing yeah. I think is a humongous mistake, and I may be wrong here, but I think it was a huge mistake in Windows 7, is the libraries.
Libraries.
Do you know
I don't know if I've used the libraries.
Oh,
I've
okay,
seen
so
the
run
link
the little
to
Explorer guy. It's the bottom left-hand corner. Your bottom left-hand link. Run the Explorer, dude.
Oh, yeah.
And you'll see documents, music, pictures, videos. And what
yes.
a library is this is I can only barely explain this to a programmer, but I'm never going to be able to explain this to my mom. But what happened is that over time, people came to have music in various different folders and documents and pictures and videos in several different folders, and it was all very confusing. And a library is a kind of folder that shows you the contents of multiple other folders. It looks just like a regular folder, except it's actually showing you the sum or the union
folders.
Of what's in multiple folders. If you ever drop anything into a library, you may wonder, where does it go? Because it could go into any of them or all of them. What is it going to do? There is a specified folder that is the magical default folder for new things that are put into the library. And this whole thing is incredibly confusing, and it just makes you kind of wonder, like, your music is going to get even more disorganized, and it's even one less. Like, for some reason, they made that particular part of the Windows experience already confusing enough. They made it even worse.
Well, file systems, I think, are one of those things that just nobody really wants to, except for programmers. Nobody right. cares about the file system. They just want to put files. Have you ever been to the average user's computer? It's like everything is on the desktop.
Uh-huh.
Which on one level seems insane. It's like, well, how can you find anything when you just have a bunch of crap on your desktop? But most users, A, don't work with that many files anyway, right? And B, to them, it's just one lump of stuff.
Here, you know, try this just to amuse me. You're sitting there at your Windows 7 computer?
Yes.
All right, so go into Explorer.
Yes.
Under Libraries, click on Music.
Yeah.
Do you have like sample music there?
I do.
Double click on sample music.
Yep.
Okay, what's in your address bar right now? What does it say in your address bar?
Libraries, music, sample music.
All right, now hit Alt D.
Yeah.
Now what does it say in your address
bar? It says C, users, public, music, sample music.
Right, which is different, right? So there's this backwards compatibility mode, which is that the address bar, they changed the address bar. I guess they had this in Vista too, right? I skipped Vista. They changed the address bar so that the address bar now shows
this
you
is not new.
Chunky things. But when you hit Alt D, it shows you the actual address. No, what is new is that it's not the address. The address, there used to be a one-to-one correspondence between the file location and and what it was showing you up there. Whereas now the actual file location, the path, can be completely different.
Right. Well, that's not really new because if you've invested in Vista. Yeah, that's another thing. Nice thing about Windows 7 is like the investment you made in Vista actually pays off because it's enhanced versions of the things that were in Vista that were kind of clunky in Vista.
So
and just to emphasize,
you're getting paid off a little bit for all that suffering of using an inferior operating
system.
Exactly.
That's exactly right. And just to emphasize, you mentioned Alt D.
Yeah.
Don't forget the Control E. Just like in your browser, takes you to the search bar. That's one of the things I liked about Vista that we talked about on podcast one was that everything had a search bar just like your browser. And pressing Control E will take you to it. And I just noticed they added something nice here. I'm looking at sample music and I can see add a search filter, album, artist, genre, length. That's nice. That's new. So, I mean, again, my point is that every time you turn a corner, there's something sort of nice in Windows 7, whereas in Windows Vista, there was something unpleasant or confusing at every corner. I'm a big fan, and I've already updated a number of machines here. So my hope is that people will get off XP finally, including maybe Fog Creek.
I would, except that I'm going to have to reinstall this whole computer. I swear to God, I'm going to go on a rampage. Because it's just like I've got apps that I use here every day, like that I don't remember where the original media is, where the CD is, and I have to find it and reinstall it and retype all that and reactivate them, and then some of them will be like, "Oh, you've activated this app too many times. Please go to hell."
Yeah,
and it's just infuriating. I have the system the way I want it. That's what upgrades are for.
That's true.
Well, now that we've said this so many times, maybe Microsoft will come up with a solution, or they'll have some kind of service backer.
One can only hope.
Yeah.
Now, on a slightly different topic, I noticed that we almost got to 1 million page views last week on Stack Overflow, which surprised me.
1 million page views per day.
Per day, yeah. It got up to like 940,000.
Analytics. I mean, it's definitely goes up every week. And even actually, ServerFault has started leaping up.
Yes. ServerFault is doing well. ServerFault's just a smaller, more focused audience. I don't think it's really going to be.
Yeah.
It's just the nature of the beast there.
Page views,
I don't think we're doing anything wrong. I think it's just a smaller, more focused community. Now, I also did some math. I was looking at the number of requests per second that were satisfying and actually went into Perfmon and I turned on the counter. Mm-hmm. This was this morning when it was actually peak time. Like basically like 8 to 10 a.m. PST is like peak traffic. Yeah. Oh, big time.
What the?
It's just I think it's like the middle of the day. It's like the sweet spot for all the time zones, at least in the U.S.
Yeah.
And we're doing like 120 requests per second. Which is...
Wow.
Like 7,000 requests per minute. And I was actually looking at, I don't know if you saw, but 37 Signals posted a giant blog entry about them updating their hardware and stuff. And they're doing like 11,000 requests per second. Now, granted, this is apples and oranges because we don't know what those requests are actually doing. It could be a request that says, give me every record in every database you have.
Yeah.
Or, you know, give me a CSS file, right?
Right.
It's not really apples to apples. So it's a pretty broad metric, but you know, we're doing all that on right now one server and one database server. Although I'm starting to get a little nervous about our web tier because I think we're going to have to move to multiple web servers and pay that cost of shared state, basically, where we have to deal with not putting our shared state in some place that, you know, can't span web servers.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
We sort of lucked out with
Fogbugs because I never really knew anything. I didn't understand that you could have set, application level variables.
So you didn't?
The original versions of...
Are you serious?
Yeah.
You didn't know that? That's great.
No, it's just like, you know, who needs it? Throw it in the database. Yeah. Who needs the headache? And so the first few versions of Fogbugs, I just, like, I never relied on having anything hanging around.
Wow. If you have everything in the database, you're golden because you don't have to worry about that. Now, Grant, we only do it in a few places. We have had some discipline around this. Mm-hmm. We realize that eventually we're going to pay this cost, so we've sort of tiptoed around it. Like, we know we're creating problems there, areas in our code, and we try to isolate it in, like, shared methods and stuff. But the reason I say that I'm a little bit worried is we are peaking at about 80% CPU usage right now.
No.
Yeah, which is starting to get to a little bit of a worry zone for me because I don't want to get to 90, 100%.
Well, the first thing you can do is you can move Stack Overflow and SuperUser onto a different machine.
Well, they're all on different machines already.
No, never mind.
Every site is on its own machine, actually.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's actually kind of a downside the way we have it set up because every...
You have a meta Stack Overflow machine?
Kind of, but that's like our utility machine. It's doing some other stuff. It's not just meta. It's also doing virtual machines and stuff like that. But every site that we expect to have a significant amount of traffic is on its own dedicated 4CPU server. Now, these servers are not expensive. I mean, it's all documented on the blog. These are like $1,200 servers. Mm-hmm. I don't view that as a big investment. But if we had some sort of scaling mechanism in place where we could easily run all four sites on all, say, four web tiers that we have.
Yeah.
You could have some sort of load sharing.
Sure.
Right? Where Stack Overflow having tons and tons of traffic would get the lion's share of the attention and thus you'd have scaling.
Yeah, you basically...
That's just not how we currently have it set up.
So it's just a matter of the shared state that they have in memory. And what kind of shared state is that? It's state about the...
It's mostly authentication related. When we start to do authentication for the user, like say you've typed in a post and you click submit, well, you've also put in an OpenID because we allow you to log in at the same time as the post submission. Mm-hmm. So that kicks off like redirects to your OpenID site and a bunch of other stuff. So we have to save that information somewhere. Now, we could put it in the database.
Yeah, I'm surprised it's not already in the database.
We might as well because honestly, that's like so rare. It's just not... There's no way that's going to be a performance problem for us.
Right.
So we might actually end up doing that. That might be easier than anything else.
Does that always happen on... Is there like a common URL so you could have all the logging in happen on one machine, but the other requests can be satisfied from other machine from the other three machines?
Repeat that?
So basically you say there's one machine is dedicated as the login machine. It's got a slightly different IP address or something or whatever. But the point is that based on looking at the URL... The load balancer says, oh, wait, you're doing a login redirect thing here. I have to send you to machine A because it's got all the login state.
Oh, right, sticky sessions. I think we would want sticky sessions regardless.
Is a different thing than sticky sessions.
It's different than sticky sessions. Okay.
Sticky sessions says if customer A in Chicago from IP address X first went to machine A, they will always go to machine A. Mm-hmm. And that's a different thing. Or if they first went to machine C, they would, and that allows you to take any session state, i.e., anything specific to the user, and keep it in memory, and just know that you know that they're always going to land on their same machine as they landed on 15 seconds ago. But that would solve it for you, wouldn't it?
That would solve it. But one thing I'm wondering is, we have documented cases. We have some stuff we do that we actually validate IP addresses on. Uh-huh. And we've actually seen users whose IP addresses actually shift from request to request.
Yeah, but the internet is broken for those people. I know. And it's supposedly legit. But the internet is broken for those people in so many different
really?
Ways.
Why do you say, why do you say the internet is broken for those people?
Because so many people rely on this concept of sticky sessions or class C affinity, as they sometimes call it, in the load balancers. There's so many sites that actually depend on that and assume that a given person on a given browser session is going to be coming from a given IP address. And if those people, if their system administrators have put them in some kind of situation I mean, AOL used to do this, but all the time, where basically every request is coming from a different random machine in some different random place. There are a surprising number of things that are not working about that for that person on the internet. You know, a lot of people, a lot of web developers just sort of cache the IP address that something came from and, you know, use that to detect various things.
We use it as a secondary protection against fraud in certain circumstances.
Yeah.
Very, very narrow circumstances. But it did surprise us that there were not a lot of users. This isn't that common.
Right.
I mean, but it does happen, which surprised us.
Yeah.
I mean, and it'll be like a radically different IP.
Because
we actually allow it to be on the same subnet. We allow that.
We allow you to stay on the same. Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, we're like, okay, that doesn't really – that's not a significant difference. But if you're on a totally different subnet, you might be a different user.
Right.
There are users that this does happen to.
There's some cases I can think of. You've got an iPhone and you're using the AT&T data network because you're walking around the streets of New York and you walk into your air-conditioned office and it suddenly finds the Wi-Fi network and connects to that and starts transmitting over that, and it's got a different IP address. So that's like the Wi-Fi to public data. So there's the mobile users that might happen to. But I remember, you know what's kind of interesting is I remember when Boeing built their connection service to provide Wi-Fi on airplanes, which has been shut down because they couldn't figure out how to make money doing it. But they, you know, they put satellites up all over the world. It was a pretty elaborate and expensive failed project. And I do remember reading about the architecture of that, and they actually had gone to great efforts to make sure that even as your plane moved from satellite to satellite or from station to station, that you still your packets for a given user we're still coming from the same IP address. Just because that's a slightly more better, you know, that gives you a better web experience than if that changes all the time.
So I've actually sidetracked you a little bit, and I apologize. So we were talking about sticky sessions.
Well, okay, so sticky sessions is one way of doing this, but I was actually suggesting a different way of doing this, which is to have a login server, a designated login server, that keeps this particular state. And so whenever somebody's logging in, it's going to that server that has the shared state. And when they're doing any other operation, it can go to any other server. And it would be trivial to configure the load balancer to say, oh, look, there's a login request. I'm going to send you to that one particular machine that has all the session data.
I think now that we've talked this through, our use of this shared state is so narrow that I think actually putting it in the database wouldn't hurt us. And probably we should have been doing that anyway now that I think about it. I think we just used session because it was convenient.
Right.
But there's not like a per request cost to this where we're checking that shared state. Now there is some stuff we're caching, I guess that's more of a deeper concern. So if you're running on three different servers and
you'll have three copies of the cache. I mean if you keep popping up on a different one. Yeah.
Yeah, and this is where you get into that stuff that what's the name of that? That shared state thing. It's called Velocity on the Microsoft side.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, Microsoft Velocity.
Uh-huh.
But basically, it makes these servers act like a shared memory state across these 10 servers that you have. They all have just all 10 of them be like a giant hash table of memory.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So you're basically pooling memory across these servers.
No kidding.
Yeah.
It can't be fast.
See? Hold on. Microsoft Velocity. Well, yeah, there's a little bit of a cost. I just cannot remember the name of what this competes with. I'm sure that... Yeah, scalable in-memory application cache.
Uh-huh.
It's still in CTP, surprisingly.
We're Googling like crazy for our listeners here. Is it Hadoop?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Hadoop. And I think there's some other names, but that's a good search.
The Stack Overflow podcast, we do the research, so you don't have to.
That's right.
Really exhaustive and thorough research in advance that we do before we suggest things.
But the concern here is with our current naive caching system where the cache is per machine, it doesn't span machines.
Right.
Say you get shifted from server 1 to server 2. Well, server 1 has a bunch of cached information about your queries.
About
and
you. Yeah.
And then server 2 is like, whoa, I don't know anything about you. So it has to pay the cost of putting all that stuff back
into. So it's just a waste.
You're duplicating this information on multiple servers. So
okay,
it's kind
so
of
then
waste.
You turn on the sticky server feature or the class C affinity or whatever.
That's one way to solve it.
And then you'll get way more cache hits. And if somebody moves IP addresses, you know, darn, then they just don't get a cache hit. They have to go deep to the database.
Yeah, that is true. It's actually not that common for someone to shift IP, so that could be a rational solution as well.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's what we're looking at. It's all based on, you know, solving the problems we have at the time we have them. And now we're starting to have the very beginning of the problem of we're outgrowing a single quad-core 8-gig server.
Right.
Which is, one of those classic, quote-unquote, good problems to have.
You know, even if you put, what's their faces, the Google friggin' Spider on its own server.
What do you mean?
Give the Google Spider its own server to serve.
Oh.
Right, because isn't the Google Spider, like, 20% of our traffic?
Some, but we just have so much traffic now that it's just a lot of little requests from all over the world,
right,
literally.
Right.
It's a long tail problem now.
No, but I mean, there's probably 4 or 5 spiders that come from unique IPs or are easily identifiable that a load balancer could move those to a different machine and at least not interfere with their regular customers.
It could. I mean, once we have more than one server. We have plenty of servers in the data center, so let me just be clear that we have spare servers we're waiting to bring online to do exactly this. It's really just, this is really a software problem at this point.
Yeah.
Not a hardware problem.
Someone was listening to us and thinking, God, those guys are such bad programmers, they didn't scale it, make it scalable to begin with. I would never do this. And that person is an idiot. So if you were thinking this, you're an idiot.
Wow, we're abusing our audience now. Is that where we are on the podcast?
Well, just a small percentage of somebody out there is being very smug that they engineered something before it needed to scale. Like they, because you know what? That way, you may not actually have a startup. Your startup may not actually get off the ground. You may not actually have customers. And you put all that engineering effort into scaling that you never need. I can tell you way more stories about little Nikki two-person startups that built ginormous systems that would have been able to handle Twitter-like traffic. And never got more than 1,000 hits a day.
Yes.
And that was on their launch day when they were in TechCrunch. There are far more stories of that than of people that fail to scale to meet the actual needs of their customers, of which there is exactly one story, and it's Twitter, and it doesn't seem to really hurt them.
No, but that's the story that everybody remembers, though. That's the one they always think of. It's the one that immediately comes to mind. Yeah.
And actually, even eBay had some little stutters. But you know what? It just didn't. Okay, yeah. So it sucked in the early days of Twitter because they had trouble scaling.
Well, you're solving the core problem, which is build a service that people give a damn about.
Right.
And then that's your real problem to solve, not because scaling. I mean, really, and I'll cite this 37 signal story. Is basically you just throw money at it. I mean, this is easy to solve. You can't really throw money at the get people to give a crap about what you're doing.
Exactly. Problem. Well,
that's,
I mean, you can't.
Not a problem that responds to money.
You can have, you can have Super Bowl ads. I mean, people have tried to throw money at the nobody gives a crap problem.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's just a question of putting your problems in the right order.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
So there. Anyway, these few listeners have now turned off the podcast in disgust and they're searching for the unsubscribe button.
They're off scaling their application. Millions of users concurrently.
I guess this is sort of a part of the you ain't going to need it philosophy. Like, don't do stuff that you haven't proven that you need yet.
Well, you want to think about it some. I mean, you don't want to go in totally blind and naive. That's dumb.
Right.
But you want to think about it, but just the right amount.
Right.
And the right amount obviously is debatable, but...
Don't do something so that you would have to change every single line of code in order to scale beyond one machine.
Like, in our case, we knew this shared state was going to be an issue, so we kind of tiptoed around that area of the code.
Yeah.
Like, ooh, here we have the shared state problem. Let's, compartmentalize this a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't fully solved the problem, but we've thought about it,
In advance, and you know that this is going to be a thing that you cross when you get to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's probably the right way to go about it. Well, because it's the way we're doing it, so of course it must be the right way.
Hey, we don't have any listener questions, but we should take a Stack Overflow question at least.
Oh, yeah.
Just to make this, this has been fun, but... Do you have any good ones? I think I might have had a good one somewhere.
Well, I do, but it's kind of self-serving.
How do I move the turtle in?
No, actually, I got one. It's actually a server fault question, and it's a good one because it's something that we needed internally.
Okay.
So one thing we've done in a kind of ad hoc basis is periodically check to see if people are hitting our particularly Stack Overflow inappropriately.
Mm-hmm.
They're hitting it like a millions of times per second, or somebody actually pointed a patchy bench at us, which really pissed me off. Basically, anomalous things that are happening to you on the HTTP request side.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this really nice tool, Log Parser. that Microsoft has had for a long, long time. It's kind of a generic tool that lets you take any sort of log and use a SQL-like syntax to get data back out of it. And since I love SQL, you know, it's a very natural way for me to work. It's just write these queries that I'm actually querying the IIS logs. I'm not querying a database. I'm querying a giant 2 gigabyte text file.
Which it then has to scan the entire thing to do your query.
But, yeah. But it's actually really fast. It's written in C and it's all optimized and stuff. And it does about as good a job as you could do without coming up with some crazy MapReduce cluster and solving it that way. So then the challenge was coming up with queries that actually show us, well, what weird things are happening on your website? Like what statistically anomalous things are happening on your website? So I wrote a question, recommended log parser queries for IIS monitoring.
What's the number?
It is 45516. And what I tried to do here was share with people, like I really had trouble coming up with these queries. I had trouble slicing and dicing the data in ways that made sense and actually showed me what I needed to see. So I was trying to put the sort of information out into the world that I would have liked to have found myself when I had started this process. You know, this is the whole leaving the trail of breadcrumbs argument. And this is really one of the reasons I started all these sites is I just want to share useful information with people so that they can, you know, share even more useful information with me later, right? I want people to improve these queries.
Right.
So some of the queries, let me give you some examples of some of the things that we find. More basic
favicon
things.
Favicon is using all our, it's the highest, most bandwidth used, by URL, so I guess that doesn't
Yeah,
really
so you
much.
Break down, like, what URLs are the most requested on your website. Now, for us, this isn't a huge surprise. Then also, like, how much bandwidth is being used by each one of those URLs? How many times are these URLs being hit? And these are different queries, because sometimes you'll find files that are really small that get hit a lot.
Oh, yeah,
don't
you can
really
see
matter.
This. You can see Googlebot going crazy, but what's OmGillyBot?
OmGillyBot is like a forum indexer. Oh. I think it tries to bring like forums as first-class citizens into search results with mixed results. It's actually kind of a neat service. It's omgilly.com. I'll go ahead and link that in the show notes.
It's kind of abusive.
And then,
yeah.
It can be. It depends. The challenge with search engines is sometimes they hit you a lot, the spiders.
Yeah.
And for some of these like fifth and sixth tier search engines.
Right.
it's not even worth the cost of the bandwidth that they're hitting you with.
Right.
I mean, you don't want to be a jerk and say you can't index us, but it's kind of a weird cost balance there.
Right.
Now, moving down in these queries, the bottom three are really the interesting ones when it comes to users who have done something that they shouldn't have or accidentally set up their RSS reader to pull you every 10 seconds. Basically, we're breaking it down by IP and user agent. Now, user agent is that little string that's sent to your website every time a request is made.
Right. It's supposed to say what kind of browser you...
Right. And when you don't have that string, that's actually kind of a negative sign. Like if we have, you know, 10,000 hits from something that has no user agent, I'm really likely to block that. Because
that's really weird. What the hell? Who doesn't have a user agent?
Well, I know. It's some kind of crazy bot. Because even bots usually fill in the user agent with something useful.
Yeah, they use curl.
Yeah, or just wget.
Yeah.
Get or whatever it's called. Like somebody hits you like 5,000 times with wget.
Yeah.
The other pet peeve I have, and some of these queries will show this, is I show the average size of the response that goes back to the browser. A lot of the more poorly written bots don't use gzip compression, which is like a total pet peeve of mine, that it's pulling down the raw HTML, which is like five times larger than the compressed version. So it's one thing to hit us like Googlebot, and all the well-written bots use compression. So every time they hit you, they're pulling down the compressed version, save your bandwidth, you know, everybody's happy. But then you have some crappily written bot hit you like 10,000 times, and they'll pull down hundreds and hundreds of megabytes worth of bandwidth from you, which I have a huge problem with.
Yeah.
So again, I'm really likely to block you. And when I say you, I mean the IPs that these things are happening on. If you show up hitting us more than Google, using more bandwidth than Google, and realize that Google uses tons of bandwidth from us. Google is spidering us incredibly aggressively.
Which we kind of want. Yeah.
It's almost like real time.
Yeah.
I mean, people say, wow, how did you do this? How does you know, Stack Overflow show up like within 10 minutes of me posting a question? It's in Google. And that's really Google is doing that. I mean, they just have a really kick-ass, you know, spidering infrastructure. They know that where our site is really popular, and they have their spiders, you know, set to do this. And they do it in a smart way. They don't they don't spider us abusively. I had to actually block Yahoo because Yahoo totally spiders abusively. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't respect limits.
Yeah.
They'll make like 10 requests per second.
What is Yahoo using what used to be Inktomi's search engine?
I don't know what it is, but talking about it just pisses me off because Yahoo, number one, they don't give us any traffic hardly at all. Right. And their spider has to be.
Their spider is not working so well.
Oh, it's terrible. And you know who on Twitter, actually, Marco Arment of Tumblr was actually commiserating with me and saying, yeah, I had to block Yahoo too because we had all these problems about Yahoo just spidering like very, very abusively. There's all this art to writing a spider.
Sure.
Like if you write a spider and you hit a site and you see that the site is slowing down as you hit it.
Right.
You throttle down.
Yeah.
And
that stuff is that stuff, I mean, they're very simple algorithms for that. You basically measure the clock time to get a response.
But and if then you look at
you
these
wait
queries,
that long before you hit them again.
If you look at these queries I've built, you'll find that so many bots are not that well written. I mean, they don't do it in a smart
Yahoo
way. I
think Yahoo is one of the big ones that they'd be doing better.
Oh, they're bad. They're really bad. They're totally abusive.
Bad Yahoo.
Yeah.
No,
so that was one of the reasons that I came up with these queries was to identify we had these huge spikes. And there's another question I had on server fault about that. But these queries are great. Now we have a scheduled task that runs these. I wrote a little console app that shells out to log parser and runs all these. And it sends us this nice HTML email identifying, you know, sort of the top N of all these queries.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Good question. Well, we're mostly out of time. I have a request of our listeners. If you're listening to this show, we're trying to organize these Stack Overflow Dev Days, and I've found a lot of good speakers on a lot of topics. But what I really want is some Python speakers, people to do a Python tutorial in each of the 10 cities. And I don't have any Python speakers lined up at all, and I don't really know who the good Python teachers and Python tutors are. So if you've ever gotten a Python tutorial in person and you've heard somebody speaking on Python who you thought was absolutely brilliant and fun to listen to and taught you a lot in an hour, which is what we want to happen at the Stack Overflow Dev Days, could you please tell me who they are and what their name is and even where they live? And do that by emailing that to devdays@stackoverflow.com, which is our standard Dev Days address for any kind of Dev Days question about Dev Days. We still have a few seats left also for the Developer Days if you want to come to the conference in a few cities. Most of the cities are sold out, but I think we still have Los Angeles, Austin, Cambridge, England, Amsterdam, and maybe Boston a little bit. So in those five cities, I'm pretty sure we still have a few seats, but please hurry up because we're just about to sell out the whole thing, and then it'll be over. Over, I tell you. If you have any questions for me and Jeff, it's something you want us to talk about, or if you have any feedback on this podcast or any previous podcasts, please record a MP3 file or Ogg Vorbis and email it to podcast@stackoverflow.com, or you can call the podcast hotline at 646-826-3879. We really want to hear your questions and to engage our so-called audience. There's a show notes for this podcast. We'll go up on the Stack Overflow blog located at blog.stackoverflow.com, where you'll also find a link to the transcript page, a wiki, and we really need your help if you can volunteer for just a minute or two of your time to take some tiny part of this podcast and type it into that wiki there, which is linked to from blog.stackoverflow.com for the benefit of the hearing impaired and the search engines who can then index the contents of this podcast and all that kind of stuff. That would be greatly appreciated. That's all I got.
See you next week.
See you next week.
You've been listening to Stack Overflow with Jeff Atwood and Joel Spolsky.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Joel Spolsky. Our website editor was Jeff Atwood. The series producer is Jeff Atwood.
This is Phil Windley. I hope you'll join me next time for another great presentation from Stack Overflow here on IT Conversations.